It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
There is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity. I pledge that I will serve you with integrity and humility.
The most important objective for our country right now is stability. Governments cannot eliminate volatility in markets.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. Welcome to the programme. So Ewan, the Prime Minister has been forced to pull a vote on the government's house building plans. This is kind of hugely important, isn't it?
Yeah, it's another one of those thorny issues which seems to keep coming back. We've had talk of Brexit this week and now house building. It's something that governments of both colours have really struggled with. 45 backbenchers, Tory backbenchers, have signed an amendment which would have stopped the imposition of top-down house building targets on local councils. A lot of Tory MPs feel very strongly about this, and it is getting in the way of the government's plans.
Yeah, the likes of Theresa Villiers, of course. It's the issue of, you know, those leafy, conservative-leaning constituents not wanting to have extra house building where they are. And yet, you know, the numbers are very difficult, and this is a really thorny issue. People like the boss of Bright Blue, which is a conservative think tank, resigned only just earlier this week, citing one of the issues being homes, that younger people who should be voting Tory aren't because they can't get on the housing ladder.
Yeah, he said that the Tories have failed millennials, and he said housing is a big, big part of that. Now, the Tories promised 300,000 new homes a year by the mid-2020s. That was the manifesto pledge. To bring you up to date with the numbers, Caroline, 205,000 housing starts in the latest financial year.
Okay, that sounds good, but I wonder, A, how much are they being sold for? Where are they in the country, those homes being built?
Yeah, I think those are two questions. It is quite good relative. It's better than we've been doing in recent years. We're actually doing very well in the early noughties, and then there was the financial crash,
right,
and the numbers dropped off a cliff down to about 120,000. And I think the danger now, of course, is as we head into a recession, is that house builders start to pull back and say, well, this is not a good time to build houses, and you get that.
Yeah.
And I think that is a danger. But yeah, you do ask a good question about where they are and how much they
cost.
Well,
I do know also that the size of new homes being built, I was really shocked to see that actually in city centres, the size of a new home is about 64 square metres. That's like 600, 700 square metres. It's not huge. It's like a couple of bedrooms. It's a flat, not a huge house.
Yeah, and I think that same bit of research said that the average home across the country is about 90 square metres, which, you know, if you think of a house,
it's quite small. Yeah,
it's really not big at all. Actually, if you get the train around the country and you look at the houses popping up in the countryside, then it does seem, this is totally anecdotal to me, that there are quite a lot popping up. They all look pretty small.
Yeah, I think they are. Mind you, I think at least if you're a house builder, a large kind of company, at least you can, you know, they complain that the planning regulations are difficult. Ewan, I'm going through my own planning headaches right now. I'm trying to get through a little bit of building work on my own property. And boy, it is not easy dealing with the authorities in London.
Yeah, because the government has deregulated a lot of this stuff quite
a
lot, haven't they?
Yeah.
And they've made a lot of stuff easier. But obviously yours is still getting gummed
I know,
up, is it?
Because I'm
are you being a tricky customer?
No, I'm not being a tricky customer, sir. I am just in a conservation area. That's the problem. Even though I'm surrounded by an area that is not, so it's very odd. Anyway, that's all the housing chat, and the problems of Rishi Sunak around, you know, the agenda that really just highlights the weakness. He's only a month into office.
Yeah, it's pretty tricky, isn't it? We're a month in and he's already, it's not quite a rebellion, but he's had to sort of give up on this important thing, because it just doesn't look like it's going to sail.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on though and talk about the Supreme Court, because that was another major decision this morning that we want to focus on. So the Supreme Court in London has rejected a bid by Scotland's government to call another independence referendum. Yes, it's IndyRef 2. The court said that the plan went beyond the powers that Holyrood had been given by Westminster, and that another vote couldn't legally take place without the UK government's approval.
Well, reacting to the ruling, Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon says that Scottish democracy will not be denied. Well, joining us now to discuss this is Linda Towers, Director of Public Law at the Scottish law firm Morton Fraser. Linda, thanks so much for joining us on the programme today. Now, did the Scottish government really have much chance of success in this case?
I think it depends whether you ask the lawyers or the politicians. I think what the court have done today is very much approach this from a legal point of view. What does the wording of the Act say? And they made it very clear that they weren't making a political decision on whether or not there should be Scottish independence. They were looking at the words of the Act. And they've decided on what is a complex decision that, in fact, the Scottish government does not have the power to hold a second referendum without the Westminster Parliament giving them the permission to do so.
Okay, this is quite an explosive decision, isn't it? In the ruling, the court rejected parallels that were drawn to other cases like Quebec and Kosovo. Were those good comparisons for the SNP to have made?
Well, I think they have to make those comparisons because the SNP have been very much, this is the SNP as a party, not as a government, have been relying very much on the fact of self-determination of a nation, and that Scots are a nation in that context and therefore are entitled to their right to have a second referendum. The Scottish government adopted those submissions but didn't rely on them in any way other than saying they were there. And the Scottish government relied in their submissions on the legal arguments around the powers of the Act. But at the end of the day, it is a very important decision for Scotland. And the court, I think, have taken a very pragmatic approach in how they looked at it. They could have, the thinking was, have decided it was premature, but they've now set out that that was not in fact the case, and that the Lord Advocate was very entitled to take the approach that she did in bringing the matter in front of the Supreme Court. So that has helped clarify the position of, because this is the first time that's been done in Scotland in the 23 years of the Parliament. So that's a very important point to have made. But on the substantive point, it's a relatively short judgment on that point, but quite clear on the thinking of the court.
Well, the SNP are clearly not going to take this lying down. What can they take away from this that is of comfort to those who want another independence vote?
That's a difficult one to say at this stage. Obviously, the UK government have said they would comply with the decision of the court. That is true also of the First Minister. She's on the record as saying that she would accept that. And it will be interesting to see whether or not they now decide, as the Scottish government, that they're going to go with what was stated in the pathway, if you can put it, which would be leading to them running the next election, whatever that means, and whether or not that's a general election or a Scottish government election, as a sort of de facto referendum on Scottish independence. But from a legal point of view, that's very, very difficult to see how that would work and whether or not the opposition parties in Scotland would agree to that anyway.
But Linda, are there any other legal avenues therefore open to the SNP now?
Not really, not in respect of this particular matter. And we may also see, although it's not been said, it may be that this now goes on to the back burner, that the Scotland Act could have been amended by the UK government. That would have been seen as inflammatory to make it absolutely clear that no further referendums could happen. That may not now be necessary, but the only way forward at the moment would appear to be if the UK government decides to grant an order in council, a Section 30 order, which is what they did in 2013 to allow the 2014 referendum to happen, to give the Scottish Government specific powers to hold that referendum within a particular timescale. But those powers have now expired.
What would it mean if the Scottish Government tried to move unilaterally on this? You know, they've picked a date, haven't they, next October, when they want to hold a referendum. What sort of legal problems would it cause if they decide just to go ahead on this?
Well, they would, first of all, the outcome would not be fully internationally recognised. And the First Minister has said that she wants any referendum to be internationally recognised so that they are a proper state, if I can put it that way, and will be recognised internationally. If they went ahead with a referendum without any powers, then that puts that aim perhaps in doubt at least. There's all sorts of questions as well about whether or not it would be appropriate to spend money on something because referendums are not cheap, on staging another referendum. And the chances are that would be challenged in the courts, again, that they did not have the powers. Somebody would challenge that, either politicians or perhaps groups or individuals within Scotland, I suspect, and probably also the UK government.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com. The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Now, Nigel Farage popped into the media consciousness again recently, talking about a Tory plot to betray Brexit. That was after that report that the government was considering putting the UK on a road to closer ties with the European Union. But perhaps less known is that the former UKIP and Brexit Party leader has a side hustle, and that is penning an investment newsletter called Fortune and Freedom.
Well, of course, after spending two decades in the City of London as a commodities trader before becoming the face of leaving the EU, Farage does have a lot to say about investing. And Bloomberg's Harry Wilson has spent months looking at whether Farage's strategies actually make you money. Harry, I thought this was such a brilliant piece on the Bloomberg Terminal on the UK website about Nigel Farage. He wanted to make Britain take back control. And I suppose, what is the sort of information that Farage has included in his personal finance newsletter?
Anything and everything, really. So what you get is undiluted Nigel Farage talking about financial markets, talking about crypto, talking about commodities, talking about inflation.
Does he do a video and a newsletter then?
So there's a podcast and there is a video with that, and then you have the newsletter itself. So this Fortune Freedom, I should add, is a free one. So this is anyone can sign up to this. Okay. And you get every day delivered to your email box, the condensed thoughts of the company that he's working for, Southbank Research, and sometimes the words from the man himself.
Now, I've seen some of these, and these emails are not brief, are they? They're pretty long, and they come thick and fast.
They do. So you get an awful lot of them. Sometimes they're on general subjects, as I say, but quite often you get into this quite quirky world where they'll start promoting some fairly interesting trading strategies. So one of their recent ones they've been talking about is a thing called the cash surge calculator, which they tell us was so secretive and valuable that the algorithm for it which had to be buried in a vault under the Nevada desert. Nice. And what it equates to basically is a strategy for investing what they call cash windows, where Americans invest in their 401k plans, retirement plans, every couple of weeks, and you can invest at those moments when the market should surge. That at least is the theory anyway.
Oh. Okay, so that's the thing. And that's the bit that I think is so interesting, right? Because you've crunched the numbers, you've put a nominal 100 grand to track and follow these sorts of trading strategies, recommendations, what exactly does he call them, I think is quite interesting. And the bottom line is, do you make money if you follow Nigel Farage's newsletter?
Not at the moment. So this is a slightly different one. So you obviously have the free service, but what we did was we took our £99 and we subscribed to a thing called UK Independent Wealth. This is the fee paying. So this is the really good stuff. And in here is they have a portfolio of stocks that you can follow. There's 16 stocks. So there's some fairly sort of blue chip companies, a couple of ETFs. And we had a go at just tracking the performance of these recommendations. So this all kicked off. His first recommendation. Oh, sorry. I should add that Nigel Farage is very clear that he does not provide advice. So these are he is merely a sort of a marketing face for this service, but we followed the recommendations, the stock recommendations in this thing, and what we found was, yes, you did lose quite a bit of money. So at the moment you'd be down if you put yourself against index, you're off about £25,000 roughly.
So basically, if you put the 100 grand into the Nigel Farage associated kind of investments, you would be down 25,000 versus just putting your money into a FTSE index?
FTSE All Share, FTSE 100, either of those trackers, yes, you'd have done considerably better than investing in this collection of stocks in the UK Independent Wealth portfolio.
And so what was the conclusion about why it was a bad investment? I mean, you know, one could say timing, like a lot of people are doing badly at the minute.
Yeah, so the selection of stocks isn't a crazy one or anything like that. What you've got, though, is that there aren't really that many stocks in the portfolio, at least not compared to a normal stock portfolio. So I went and spoke to a former fund manager to get his views on this portfolio, and his main takeaways were, look, if you're going to do this type of thing, you really need to probably have more like 30 or 40 stocks to get proper diversification. And then on top of that, his other point is, well, the UK market just hasn't really done that very very well. Obviously, the FTSE 100 has still outperformed this thing, but generally his view is you should probably be putting your money in markets outside the UK at the moment. The UK stocks are particularly unloved, which has obviously been another drag on the performance of the portfolio.
And talking of unloved things, he's also pretty keen on crypto, isn't he, which has been playing out well, I'm sure. And he's quite keen on gold, isn't he?
Yes, so crypto and gold are two things that make frequent appearances in Farage's newsletters and in his podcast. So in crypto, yes, they frequently promote crypto products, crypto services. They always have a slight note of caution saying, look, don't put all your money in this sort of thing. But often when you read the literature that you get when you sign up to these emails, you get all sorts of extraordinary stats about, if you put your money into this, you could have made several thousand percent return. So although they're saying, you know, be very careful, on the other hand, there is quite a bit of hype that they have around crypto. Equally on gold, the portfolio that we looked at, they recommend something between 15 and 25% of your money being in gold. And that hasn't been a stunning investment as yet. But again, this comes back to what is one of their sort of central themes, which has been about inflation. And in fairness to Farage and his South Bank newsletters, they were pretty early in calling the spike in inflation.
How does the kind of political philosophy, I suppose, of Nigel Farage, the pro-Brexit, anti-EU, how does that translate into the newsletter and into investing? I mean, because, again, like really focusing on crypto and gold, that has some kind of implications, I suppose, for your worldview, right, doesn't it?
Well, the very title of the thing, you know, freedom and fortune, it's a pretty obvious allusion to the Brexit campaign and the use of language around the marketing of it. Take back control of your finances. It's all very much marketed at people who are, I suspect, of a Brexit supporting persuasion. I mean, for instance, if you're a hardcore Remainer, I doubt Nigel Farage is someone that you would ever be listening to on financial matters, let alone anything else.
Okay, but on that point, is anyone complaining about this newsletter or anything else to do with this sort of advice?
It's hard to say, really. I don't. You'd have to probably work in their complaints department at Southbank to know that. So frankly, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, obviously, if someone had religiously followed this advice in the way that we have done, they might be having some questions about their performance when they look at the relative performance of the index. And obviously, that would also save them an awful lot of hassle. It's a lot easier just to go and buy an ETF and put your feet up than it is to be dossing in and out of various stocks.
Yeah, easier and cheaper. What's the cost of all this? You say you subscribe to the newsletter for £99. Is that it?
Well, yes, that is it. Of course, when you sign up to this thing, there are that's when the sort of real deluge of marketing begins. And so, you know, up comes a page saying, "Do not close this page. These offers will never be seen again." And so you start tallying your way down this page and he actually had a little sort of totalizer going along the corner, and as you pass each service it tots up the value, and if I remember rightly, I think when I got to the end of this thing it was about £11,700 ish.
This was what they were asking you to pay to subscribe to these investments, is that it, or information?
So they have a range of different newsletters. So this was to subscribe to other newsletters, and obviously they were saying that, you know, lucky me, I could have a discount if I subscribe to all these things today. I briefly raised the issue with my editors of whether Bloomberg expenses stretch to several thousand pounds, but I think we decided that £99 was probably enough for us.
I love it that you've done the deep dive into the numbers. I mean, Nigel Farage is well known as a salesperson, I suppose. So, you know, perhaps what was his defence? As you say, he's saying that it's not advice, that it's...
Yes, so I have to say my conversation with Nigel Farage wasn't particularly long. I think it was probably all of a minute.
A minute?
Okay. And, you know, obviously we had put up all of our questions and writing it to him beforehand, but obviously wanted to give him a chance to get his comments. His main point was essentially, I don't provide advice, and I think the call went dead at the moment I asked, so do you follow your own recommendations? At that point, the line broke for whatever reason.
Very interesting.
Harry, thank you so much for being with us. It's a great bit of reporting. I just love the fact that you have crunched the numbers, that you've gone through the function. What is the function on the Bloomberg terminal for trying to do this? If you want to map some investment advice or criteria.
Yes, portfolio, PRTU. I've had great fun with it.
So you went off and actually did the legwork. And I think that is absolutely brilliant because, you know, Nigel Farage popping up in the political sphere, but he's here in the City of London also.
Yeah, offering freedom and fortune. Freedom, perhaps, but it sounds like fortune deferred.
Maybe not. Bloomberg's Harry Wilson, thank you so much for your time here on Bloomberg UK Politics. Been great to speak to you. So, coming up then in tomorrow's programme, lots more to bring you.
Yeah, we've got Prime Minister's questions today and a couple of interesting people who say they're not standing at the next election. Chloe Smith and William Ragg, two young members of the Parliamentary Party, so they're not going to stand for the Tories in the next election.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.